Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
This podcast is brought to you by Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. One of the things I love about Indeed is that it just makes hiring all in one place so easy, because you just get unparalleled access to job seekers. Plus, listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/WCG. Just go to Indeed.com/WCG right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/WCG. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Stevie, we finally got set up. Technology was against us, but we battled against it for about 20 minutes and we're in sync. This is the Entitled Banter podcast, the UBP, the UB Stevie.
Welcome to the Stevie.
Yeah, it's a special edition. Stevie Ward herself, industry veteran Stevie Ward, to give you your full title. Because I am Scott Tilford. That's Stevie Ward. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm not too bad. I feel like I've not talked all day. I didn't record a morning news, and I feel like my throat might give out at any minute, but it's fine for now, so we'll crack on with the podcast. The Entitled Banter Pod is where we take people's questions, talking points, whatever they've got going on in the industry. And sometimes it's with Jules Gill, sometimes it's with Josh Brown. Today it's with Stevie Ward. It just depends who's available, which brain I can get a hold of and bring in to do a bit of a chat for a while. So we'll get through as many talking points and questions as we can. First one from Tarnished Yaz, who says, first off, where has Stevie been hiding? Amazing insight into the industry. Question is, what impact has social media had on the game industry, and has the more direct interaction and exposure been a positive? Love to hear your thoughts. I thought we should open on this, and then we'll do, people have asked, where's Stevie from, etc., but we'll get there. What do you think about social media's impact on gaming?
It's been huge, especially for games marketers. I mean, I've been on the games marketing side of the industry for so long, and just being able to connect with so many more people around the world and show them that a game even exists has been absolutely huge, and we do have social media to thank for that. Of course, with things like voice communications, Ventrilo, starting with Ventrilo and then moving on to like in-game comms and stuff like that, it's also made multiplayer, it's completely revolutionized multiplayer games, because I think we all forget that Skype and that is also a social media. I think that social media has been absolutely incredible for games. I think obviously there's a lot of questions to be raised around online gaming culture and everything that came with that, because obviously it's been fantastic for community building, because you could all get together and share experiences, share UGC, puzzle solve, help each other out with different levels and stuff like that. But then obviously it also created a really big hotbed for toxicity and stuff like that as well. So I think that...
What's UGC? That's a fancy term.
UGC is community manager speak for user generated content. So if you think about things like fan art, if you think about things like cosplay, that's user generated content. And then if you think about going back as far as, like, I think I mentioned Reption 3 in like the last podcast about how it was one of the early things that actually gave players a level designer, and being able to create your own levels, that is UGC, that's user generated content.
See, this question's interesting, because you've taken it in a completely different direction than I would have done. It made me think of the idea of sort of reactive communities and fan bases, and the feedback that people get online, where the assumption is that they listen to what the fans want, and then the sequel goes in that direction, or a plot beat goes in that direction. We do DLC based on what the fans said. Like Fallout 4's Season Pass, when that game first came out, and it was Bethesda out there saying, we'll do whatever you guys want, kind of thing. What do you think of that stuff? We've talked quite a bit about like Kickstarter and the idea of like authorship and authorship and whatever. Like, I'm a big proponent of, like, the artist dictates kind of thing. But that side of it, I guess it depends how real that actually is. Like, that idea, I mean, it's always the production cycles and how far into a development something is, whether it can react to what an audience is saying. But I guess what comes to mind for those kind of conversations?
Well, I think forums was the first big version of this for games. I think if you look at the early sort of MMO stuff, World of Warcraft, Ultima, EVE Online, online forums and the technology to be able to respond to stuff and have big feedback threads on things was very, very important when it came to developers that were working on specifically live service, because they needed to be able to iterate to make the next patch. And to be able to do that, you're working with very small QA teams at the time. QAs weren't the big sort of behemothic 50 person, you know, Ubisoft kind of army of people. You know, it would be a couple of people in the studio, and, you know, they wouldn't catch all the bugs. They wouldn't be able to catch all the different balancing issues that World of Warcraft had. And forums created such an amazing way to actually get that feedback. And obviously it then also created amazing ways for players to abuse members of staff, and the marketplace that opened up for being able to sell items in World of Warcraft, and the fact that it created its own economy, not even just inside the game, but outside of the game. That's what social media did when it came to those bits and pieces. But as far as the iteration cycle goes, of course, being able to ask the consumer, being able to ask the player, hey, what do you think of this patch? Hey, what do you think of this character? Was huge, but it's only useful if the dev studios in questions actually respond to that and iterate once they've gotten that feedback. I think it's easy to pay lip service to it, and that remains the same for today. It's very hard to actually do that. And I think we see that a lot with things like Twitter, where nowadays I think players are a lot more aware of, like, shut up brand, like, they don't want to hear it. Like, if I knew that I play League of Legends, right, if I knew that it was the actual character designer from League of Legends going, we're creating a new character, what would you be interested in, I'd be like, hey Becky, I'd love to see this and this. But what you get is, on a Friday, you get, so what are you guys playing this weekend? And you know, that's not the devs. You know that that's...
Have you been looking at our Twitter account again?
You know that that's a social media person, and you know, it comes off as inauthentic. And I think that, you know, we've become a lot more wise to that, and what is actually asking for feedback, and what is actually engagement with a dev studio, and what's a big brand, or is a social media group of people that don't have that much to do with the actual development cycle or aren't sending any feedback back. Obviously that's a generalization. You get people that are very good at that, you've got people that have amazing listening tools when it comes to being able to get that feedback and software. It just completely depends on what the studio is able to do and what the studio is able to work on.
I think one of those things where, like I said, it's always going to come down to the reality of the game that's being made. Like, how reactive can something actually be? I think it's always fascinating when, like, a project starts. Like, obviously, the ethos of something like Kickstarter was, we're going to say what this thing's in theory going to be a bit down the line, and then get people's feedback as they go. Different stretch goals can affect the game. Something like Mighty Number 9 was changed quite a lot as it rolled out. And I'm like, it's just one of those things where, me personally, I want the creator make the thing, and then you tell me and I'll play it and whatever. They shouldn't have to hear from me. That's my personal thought on it anyway, unless, like, the actual game is some sort of unique experience that needs, like, player feedback for it to work kind of thing. But do you have a personal preference on, like the how big of a entity the creator should be?
So this is a what is art question.
What which I love is... I've literally written my what do you call it, what's that big long thing you do at university, a dissertation was on whether games are art, and then one of the first things I ever did for Art Culture was that video games are art, because that was the whole thing in 2013, all the Roger Ebert stuff. But
So this is the thing. You can say, I painted this picture of an apple because I want you to see an apple, and I want everyone to come in to say that's an apple. Or you can paint the picture and go, if somebody looks at this and remembers that their dad gave them an apple when they were three and it was the first memory they had, and actually this is about family and longing and memory, then that's something they get from that. And if somebody else comes in and looks at it and goes, huh, that reminds me of lips, now I want to go kiss someone, then that's okay too. And I think even artists can say, like, this is the story, but what did you get from it? What did you think of that? I think that when it comes to interactivity, and this is where sometimes I think art and video games and things that are cross-media, multimedia do differ, is that you know, they create sandboxes for a reason. They create those so that you can do what you want. They create stories so that you can choose multiple narratives and bits and pieces like that. And some games are made to be broken. Some games are made to be played in ways that you wouldn't normally play a game. I don't think anyone thought when, you know, they invented Stardew Valley that a goldfish was going to play it on Twitch at some point. Like, like no one thought that, but that's the beauty of the media, is that you create art and then people look at it in different ways and make it something, or make it a cult thing, or play it their own way, or actually really love this side character nobody else has ever cared about because that's what makes it special to them. And I think that if a dev studio says, no, we want to make this with you, then the ability to do that and do that well, obviously that falls on a community manager, but that's exciting and fascinating and brilliant. If a dev studio is like, no, this is how we want you to play it. No, we're not going to make an easy mode. No, we're not going to make this accessible to anybody else. No, we're not going to make this available for people who may have color blindness to be able to play comfortably. I think that they're missing out on being able to say, hey, we want as many people as possible to have this experience and play this game. I don't think anyone makes a piece of art to go, actually, I don't really want anyone to see it. And if you did, you wouldn't release it. Same with writing a song or writing some poetry. Like, if that poetry is just for your mum, then you'd just say it to her. If you want people to see it, then you'd want everyone to see it. They don't have to necessarily understand it, but you are inviting that feedback and that sort of experience of being able to experience something on your own terms. And I think that that's important. And I think that that's what we've seen as social media has gone forward, is that more people from different groups have said, actually, could we have this on an easy mode? Could I have this so that I can play this without using my hands? Can I have an audio cue rather than a visual cue? And I think that that's beautiful and wonderful. And that's exactly what should happen. You know, easy mode, hard mode, you know, I you can go on about that forever, about what, you know, what Dark Souls actually wants you to do. They want you to quit. They want it to be hard and they want you to persevere, but I think they do want you to eventually get it. Like, if you through the fire and flames on Guitar Hero is hard for a reason, but that doesn't mean you shouldn't be able to play it on easy, because you'd also enjoy it and you want to be able to experience what it's like to feel that, and that is good.
Yes, I mean, my thing is, I kind of want more games to do, like, that idea of, like, utilizing a community, utilizing a fan base. Like, I remember the end of, the secret ending to Metal Gear Solid 5, Phantom Pain, is, like, fundamentally built on the idea of players all disarming their own nukes, because you can, like, protect your own mother base by building a nuke, and that's, like, the ultimate defensive measure that you can have. But if the whole... it's like, I think it's per platform is how it triggers. There was someone just mined the PC files after a while, because it was, like, Kojima's comment on how there'd never be full... you know, nuclear disarmament, because someone will always build the ultimate weapon or whatever. But I like the idea of, like, that kind of moving forward together. Like, it was in Death Stranding, like, everyone builds the highways and everything together. Like, I might leave resources somewhere on the map in my save, and then when you get to that point in your save, you can use them, and it's like moving forward together kind of thing. And the Metal Gear Solid 5 thing was just that was a great way of making that comment, like, through the reality of how many people were playing at once kind of thing. So I'd love, like, things like that, but it's like, that's a game that's fundamentally predicated on community involvement or a player base all interacting with it at once. But yeah, there's different ways that it can go. Question from Pinky, who says, you Stevie, which is a very good play on UBP. I probably should have opened with that, to be honest. That could have been a lot better. But could Stevie tell us a little bit about the journey that led her through the industry and eventually to What Culture Gaming?
Sure, so take a seat, children. We're going to be here for a very long time. The year was 2007.
Back in the day. And the year was 2007. Justin TV had been around for maybe couple of months. YouTube was around that year. Facebook, the year before, maybe 2 years before that. I might get my dates a bit mixed up, but we're talking about the sort of birth of that generation of social media. MySpace was around, but that's about it. And people were struggling with how to watch video games on the internet, or if anyone even ever wanted to talk about video games on TV, or even watch video game content on TV. There had been things like Games Master, a couple of different bits and pieces, but not much. And CCP Games, who are an Icelandic video company, had this amazing MMO called EVE Online, which was this single sharded, and still is, this single sharded universe where you would all play in the same world, in the same instance. And if you were big in EVE, and you were famous in EVE, or you were a dickhead in EVE, everyone knew who you were. And what that created was these incredible huge fleet battles where thousands of people could take part and lose their ships and be mad at each other. And the opportunity that created was that you could have a news show about the EVE universe, and it would be the same right. for every player. So CCP spoke to an English publishing company called MMM about creating a TV show for it, and I got chosen to be the presenter for it because I'd been playing MMOs, World of Warcraft and stuff like that, and a little bit of EVE. And it ran for 21 episodes, and it was, Wired said it was the first world's first ever TV show about an online game. So whilst
I think
Minecon had been streamed and Alliance, some esports matches and little bits and pieces on Justin had happened, there hadn't been a sort of news. I'm not sure exactly what the exact first that it was, but it was a world's first when it came to trying to make this kind of content, news content. And there was so many struggles with it. We didn't know how to market it. We didn't know if it was going to be like a pay-per-view thing. One of it was on a CD-ROM that came out in PC Gamer. Like, we didn't know how to make it a thing. We didn't know whether to charge the players for it as part of their subscription. We didn't know, you know, what it was meant to be, like how to sell it to keep it going with the company or keep it going with players. And like, and the feedback was mixed across, you know, whether it was you had to pay for it or whether it would just be free. And we televised the Alliance tournaments, which was one of the first big esports things that ever was televised. So we had the Alliance, and it still is, well, it's still running, the Alliance tournament, but we had Alliance tournament 2 was on the radio, Alliance tournament 3 was TV streamed. And that was, for me, that was like around the time that, you know, esports became a thing, and I was there, and that was really exciting. And I'm forever grateful to CCP for hiring me and keeping me on and bringing me into this crazy world. And I fell in love with it. I fell in love with the games community. I fell in love with EVE players. I fell in love with the idea of a sci-fi universe that was so weird and funny and quirky and had its own community and in jokes and videos, and I just loved it. I completely down tools. I moved to Reykjavik. I spent 4 years in the dark.
What?
I spent 4 years in the dark, working on TV bits for EVE and community management. And I am forever grateful to them for taking a chance on me, at the time a girl on the internet, which wasn't to be believed. And it was terrible. And yeah, and that's how I got my start. And
you've done many, many things. I tell you what, technology's fighting us right now, because our little video feed will not stay stable, but we are audio synced, so we can still talk. Pinky also says, what was your most awkward or embarrassing experience working in or around the gaming industry? This is for both of us, but I didn't know if you had anything that came to mind.
Awkward?
Or embarrassing?
Embarrassing?
I don't really have anything that comes to mind necessarily,
I'm quite hard to embarrass because I am a complete ham. So for me, when stuff's embarrassing, it kind of makes for a better story afterwards. Awkward, I mean, you get awkward stuff just from working on MMO petitions for that long. You know, people send in stuff complaining about bits and pieces. Had a guy blame me for his divorce because I banned him from the forum. That's awkward when like they attach the divorce papers to the petition to prove that because we hadn't let him back on a forum, it drove a wedge between him and his wife, and I was to blame for it. And you know, like, that's awkward. But again, it's just kind of it's just, that's part of the weirdness and the wildness of the community management scene back then, when you know, it meant so much to everybody, and that there wasn't a rule book for how you could respond to this stuff, or if you had to read it, or if it was something that you just be like, nope, not even gonna look at this. And that was awkward.
Yeah, I think for me, if I'm doing awkward, I haven't got anything that's embarrassing that I can think of anyway. Not that I can think of. I think like awkward stuff is just like, this is such a like basic thing, but it's when we have to like, when we try to turn over reviews in like 2 days or a day or whatever it is. And I remember the Final Fantasy VII Remake, I was playing that till 4 in the morning the night before the review embargo. just to get something recorded that morning to hit the time for it. And it's just like 9 times out of 10, we don't get something early, which, like, we're not a review-based channel necessarily, but it's nice to have the reviews for the bigger games and stuff. So it's like sometimes we'll get something that's only 2 or 3 days beforehand, and then you just have to try and live on it. And that is like, I mean, luckily it's just, it's me and my wife. So I'm just like, it's one of those times that I just need to batten down the hatches and play this thing. And luckily, like, she's totally cool with it. But it's one of those things where that's not a life, a way of living. Like, if that was like at all the time, just constant gaming, nothing else all throughout the night, 4 hours sleep, wake up, coffee, keep going. It just doesn't make sense. So I think that's one of the most awkward realities of trying to be a review-based channel, which, like I said, we've never relied entirely on the review revenue stuff, so, which is good, because I think if we had to turn everything over, especially this year, you'd be a pancake at this point. You'd be very, very flat out. Question from Rhino, who says, I recently had to explain to my son that I had to play the OG Game Boy using the streetlights when in the car at night because it didn't have a backlight. What old gaming memory would you use to show the kids of today how good they have it now?
Floppy disks. Do y'all remember floppy disks?
Yeah.
I had an Acorn and a BBC because I was a very posh middle class child.
Very
and
nice.
If your floppy disk weren't working, you couldn't play that game anymore.
There's a thing about floppy disks that, like, now that's just the universal save symbol, but any of the generations below us don't even know what floppy disks are. So that's just an icon to them.
Yeah, and like I remember I had this Alice in Wonderland game which looked amazing, and there was a map, and it was kind of goth, and it was kind of like an MUD, but it had graphics, it had some pictures, and I desperately, desperately, desperately wanted to play it, and it would be like, now insert disc 6, and you'd have to find discs, and you'd have to keep putting these discs, like these old, mm-hmm. up to like 12 or whatever it was for. I don't know how much the original mist was. But if one was corrupted, that was game, literally game over. And like, you know, like, you'd have this now, oh, I'll just re-download it, or I'll just get it from game, or I'll just, you didn't mm-hmm. have it back then, it was just done. You know, you're a kid, you can't do anything. So yeah.
Mine would be download speeds and just like the availability of everything. Like that idea of like you set something off on a 56K download, and it's like, I mean, even then it took minutes for a picture of something. Like the idea of like a downloadable game. I mean, this just makes us sound old, but it is one of those things where like Xbox Live was such a big deal. And then getting a demo for every game that was on Xbox Live. I remember getting my 360 and just sitting that first night, and I downloaded Worms because Worms 2 was on the Xbox Live Arcade.
Okay.
And,
And
I was like, that's awesome that I could just get that. I remember asking my mom, is it okay if I get this game? I've never downloaded a game before.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
This podcast is brought to you by Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. One of the things I love about Indeed is that it just makes hiring all in one place so easy, because you just get unparalleled access to job seekers. Plus, listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/WCG. Just go to Indeed.com/WCG right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/WCG. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
for. And so I remember doing that, and then like, yeah, the ability to just download stuff, and then obviously broadband connections, whatever, have come along so far in the last decade and a half. But at the time, the idea of just being able to click a button and get a game without having to go somewhere and pick it up or whatever, that's a very like instant access thing. And obviously it crosses over into the conversation on the game preservation and physical versus digital and everything else. But yeah, that ability to just, hey, that thing that you like, you can click a button and play it in like half an hour, if not faster. That's nuts, like compared to how we kind of grew up, where you had to go and get everything. Question from the 307th Gunner of 2023. How long are you willing to wait for DLC for a game before you move on? Some games DLC comes out over a year later, and that can be a nice revisit, but sometimes I've just entirely moved on from a game.
I can wait a pretty long time.
Wait until it's cheap, thank you.
I will wait until it's ready, and I will also wait until it's cheap. I play The Sims. I've played The Sims for as long as there's been The Sims, I've played The Sims. Sometimes 6 months goes by till there's a new expansion, sometimes longer. I can wait. I'll put it away and then something will come out. I will work out all of the mods I want. I'll create a brand new world. I will mod that world so that it looks era appropriate to the world in which I'm playing, depending on which kind of fantasy land I'm creating. And I will download that EP and then I will play it for a good like 3 weeks completely straight until my eyes burn, and I'll be up at 3 a.m. deleting trees that aren't appropriate and things like that, and creating my own UGC for it.
A tree that's not appropriate?
Yeah, like if I'm playing a game, like at the moment I've got like a Game of Thrones save game that I'm doing, so all the clothes are medieval, the mods are correct, the horses don't have the modern day saddles. If there's trees that aren't appropriate, I get rid of them. If there's worlds I want to use that have modern buildings, I've got mods to delete those, or I can go in and find the file and delete it. Like, I'm big on modding The Sims so that it looks exactly like I want it to. And I will be obsessive about that for 3 weeks, and then I won't play it for months, and that's how I am. But I love it, and
that's cool.
Yeah,
mine's like this question made me think of Doom Eternal. I don't know if you played Doom Eternal, but like I remember being in such a headspace for that game, and it's such a fast reactive thing that when the DLC finally came out, and it's really hard, like the DLC difficulty level is so much higher that like my brain had just disconnected from the space that I was in when I went through that campaign, and having to kind of step back into it like just randomly because the DLC's out, I just couldn't keep up with it again. So I never finished the I think it's called the Ancient Gods DLC. I never finished either of them because I just couldn't make a dent in it whatsoever. But I was in when I played through Eternal initially, I was proper into it and keeping up with everything and whatever. But to me it depends, like if the DLC for the game itself is like mechanically tight where I need to be in a certain headspace for it. Because things when Dark Souls games get DLC, I'm like, oh god, I have to get back in that mindset again. I have to remember how to, you know, deal with all of these aggressive enemies and all the different timings and everything else. Even Sonic Frontiers, me and you've not talked about Sonic yet. I don't know if you're a Sonic fan.
I like a bit of Sonic.
Okay. I like Sonic a lot. Me and Dan Durkin, our editor Dan Durkin, and I'm going to say Joe Johnston's a Sonic fan, even though he vehemently denies it. But Sonic is a thing around the office, and it's like every now and then, all of us will always check out whatever the newest Sonic game is. And Sonic Frontiers was solid enough. I had a good old time with Sonic Frontiers. But by the time that DLC came out, it was like a few weeks ago now, it's pinned in the past. Like, it was last year, and it's like trying to remember what the hell that thing felt like was just way off. And so that was one of those dividing lines of just like, you guys, they waited like way too long to put out the next series of levels, where it was just, I don't know, I needed like a different onboarding or something. If it's something that's going to be based around a certain level of momentum or gameplay mechanics or whatever, I need like a way of you reintroducing me to that world. Question from Honest NPC, who says, what was the last game you played where you genuinely couldn't believe you were actually playing it after years of hype? Theirs was Halo 3, and is this feeling now lost? Love the amazing podcast. P.S. Stevie has had awesome insights. Great hearing her takes.
Oh, thanks a lot. I really appreciate that. That's really nice. It's been really nice actually kind of being adopted by the What Culture staff whilst hot desking at What Culture and going on YouTube videos and having nice comments. It's been honestly the nicest, biggest highlight of my year, probably, coming back to TV and podcasting, and people are actually interested and want to hear what I have to say. That's really
We've got a nice little community. We've got lots of love.
Yeah, what a gorgeous community. And the answer to your question is Baldur's Gate. Oh my goodness! Like we waited, we crossed oceans of time. We've really, really waited for this, and like you know, Divinity,
how long is that since? Is it 20 years?
Oh, God, I don't know. Like, too long for me anyway. I didn't play it 20 years ago, but, like, it would have been too long anyway. And obviously having the Divinity Original Sin games, you know, it does fill that void a bit. And Divinity 2 wasn't too long ago, so I haven't been too bad recently because I think that really did help. And it was so good, like, it didn't feel, like, that long. But I'm just so happy this game exists and it's real and it's good and it's as good as we wanted it to be and it's as good as the prophecy foretold it would be. And that's just so nice. And I just think we should all celebrate. And I'm not sure why there aren't street parties. Well, there are street parties because at all the Comic Cons, like all the cosplays are starting to come in of Karlach and Asterion and all of that stuff. And you're like, this is real. And not only is it real, it's mainstreamy real. Like it's we could never have predicted that it would be so mainstream that you know influencers would be dressing up as Shadowheart and stuff like that. Like how cool.
I'm looking forward to the sweep, like the Game Awards and like the Golden Joysticks is next week. Like I don't know how this doesn't win every single, and maybe Alan Wake for like best art direction or something, but it's like I feel like Baldur's is just going to sweep it. We mentioned it on last week's podcast with me, you and Adam Strawn, but it just feels like it is this big nigh on cultural thing this year. Like you talk about the big like milestones or tentpole releases of the year, and it has been one of them. I think for me it was like Final Fantasy VII Remake was a huge one because that was just rumored for so long, and there was a version of it that was in motion apparently across the 2000s. It was that weird PS3 tech demo, and then when it finally came true, and I remember seeing the tweet they put out back in the like a couple of years ago where it was like the bombing run mission was available as a demo because that was like the one that was on PS1, and just having that in front of you, like I mean I missed demos for one thing, but then being able to do it for something that was as big of a deal as like what the hell does Final Fantasy VII Remake actually feel like or play like, that was like a massive deal. So I would take that, and then The Last Guardian as well. Like that was, I know they were both confirmed in the same year, 2016, as coming back. But like I was a huge like Ico or Team Ico as the devs and Shadow of the Colossus fan. So and I love The Last Guardian. I don't know if you played that game.
Yeah,
and it's
with Ico, I was doing some freelancing for PlayStation Access, so we had an early build of that to go and demo our Access events, but it was buggy. Like you couldn't do as much stuff with it, and I'm really glad it was as beautiful as it was, and agree. I think that there's a certain amount of, and I don't use this word a lot, but wonder with that art style. Yeah. Like I don't think it's something loads of people go for. I think Sekiro does it. I think that there's a couple of different games where you really do get that sense of scale and wonder and that kind of mood, and it does it so beautifully, and I think that there should be more games like that. I think indies do it very well, but I think that AAA sometimes forget to have that magic just in the environment, and I think that's beautiful, and it does it so well.
Shout out to Toussaint, which just came out this week. It's on Game Pass, and I think it's on PlayStation as well. But that's like a really like wondrous looking world where you're just playing as a member of a tribe, sort of trying to get back to your homeland and climb up this massive tower. But it's just a dedicated climbing game. I was looking forward to that for a while. I just started playing it last night in amongst the sea of other games that there are to get through. But Toussaint is really, really cool. It has a really lovely art style and like has that kind of wondrous tone as well. Question from Jack Jingle, who says, what's your worst gaming take? a bit like a guilty pleasure, you know it's wrong, but you lean into it all the more. And theirs is that they should play games, or that you should play games with the brightness setting above the recommended. Now, I used to do this. I used to be someone who would crank the brightness thing because I wanted to see all the detail. I didn't want to get through a game and miss something that was in a corner somewhere. So I used to always go above, but then it would do that stupid thing where say a moon is in a dark sky, it'll fracture and like all the light will come out like concentric circles because it's not rendering it properly. So I was that guy when I was younger. This year I discovered turning the big light off in my living room and actually like watching stuff properly with proper lighting. That was a whole thing before you were here, me discovering that I shouldn't leave the big light on. But I'm a changed man, but I don't know what your overall hot take is
on having the lights on. I'm going to talk about your thing for a minute. If it's a horror game and they say this is how it needs to be so that you get scared when something comes out, again, I think that's your choice to say, I want to see it before it comes out. And I think that's okay. And I think that's okay in VR as well. And I think we should all be able, we should all not judge each other when it comes to what scares us and what doesn't. She said for no reason whatsoever. So, you know, and that's one for Scott, considering you're like, our games need to be played the way the OTA wants them to be played.
I know.
You've got the lighting up.
I wasn't even thinking of it until it was when Dead Space came out. And shout out to Ash Milman over on PlayStation Access. She shared a video of like her playing with the mood lighting thing, that she, the way she had her set up for Dead Space.
Right.
And I was messaging her and I was just like, I haven't even thought of this. I haven't thought about changing my... Even though I've played a million horror games, never in a million years did I think about changing what was happening outside of the screen. I just put the game in and I play it. And that was it. And it was like one of those really obvious, you might say, light bulb moments of just like, oh, I should have mood lighting. I should have colored lighting. I should change the way that my living room looks to maximize certain games. And obviously certain things, like you said, play into it better, like Dead Space, Resident Evil, horror games or whatever. But that was my overall thing earlier this year. But in terms of like a worst gaming take, I mean, my defaults are always L.A. Noire was overrated. I hated that. GTA 5 was the death of Rockstar, etc. I don't know if you have anything that's a horrible gaming take you want to throw on the pile.
It's pronounced WASD.
What's WASD?
On your keyboard?
I've got to spell PC first before we start doing all this.
WASD. How do you pronounce the, you know, when you go up, back, forward, you know, the A-W-S-S? How do you say that out loud? And I want everyone who's listening to do that. Like, how would you say those buttons?
See, I've been reliably informed it's WASD, but I think that's what you're going to say it's not.
It probably is, but I say WASD. I can't stop.
Where's
now.
WASD?
That's how when I'm very dyslexic. That is my neurodivergent brain going WASD. Like that's how I would say that. So you know, you can come at me for it. I'm not changing. I'm not going to say GIF, not GIF. It's GIF.
No, it's definitely WASD. GIF. Even if the dude himself said it was GIF, I was like, it's right. Not, mate. You've named your own product wrong.
Yeah, like I'll fight on that one.
That's probably death of the author stuff where it's GIF.
See, you say you're one thing, Scott, but you're actually something completely different. Like you get into this and you're like, no.
If Mr. GIF was around, I wouldn't disrespect him to his face. But as soon as he's out the room, it's GIF. I mean, it just definitely is.
You'd be making so many GIFs of him being wrong. You'd be like, hey, check out this GIF. And I'd be like, I can't see anything. Please turn the lights up.
Well, it's such a UK thing as well, because we have GIF, the washing up liquid, which I think is another like cerebral clash that like maybe other countries just don't have. But there's too much real estate already taken up by GIF for them to be coming in. But I think if your worst gaming take is the WASD, pronunciation thing, then that's completely fine. I'm wading in going like, hey, this thing sucks.
Well, you're a console player, so it doesn't mean as much to you as it does to PC gamers. You know, it means a lot to us I'm not speaking on behalf of all of us, but it does mean a lot to quite a few people. I've lost friends over this, Scott. I think you're taking it seriously.
I remember when Rich Hudson, who is now over at Frontier, used to work here, and I wounded him by saying I preferred aiming on analog sticks to mouse cursor. I don't know if that's going to hurt you or not, but I definitely prefer playing first-person shooters on a console control pad.
I prefer shooters on console.
Yes!
Because
it's the right way to be.
But I could never play a MOBA on a console, so I think it's different. But I also play League of Legends one-handed, so I'm aware that I'm not the norm when it comes to that stuff.
So. Well, when we started talking, we talked about Baldur's Gate and the way that I didn't even realize that game had different UI and HUD and everything on consoles compared to how it is on PC. And it's like on consoles, it's all radial wheels and poking the analog stick at stuff. And to me, I was like, oh, they found the way around all these different things that you can do. And then you were like, dear God, you can use a mouse to do all of this stuff. There's loads of hotkeys and ways that it could be working. Like, yeah, I'm using the radial wheels. I'm a radial wheelsman.
You're a radio wheels man.
Jack Jingle also says he just completed Unpacking with his wife, which was such a pretty experience and enjoyed the unusual narrative style. Any games that we've come to later where the general approach surprised us?
I think there's games that I've played with partners that are just completely special because they are something different to what you'd normally play. There's an amazing game from Inkle Studios called 80 Days, which is a narrative version of Around the World in 80 Days, where you play a sort of a Phileas Fogg type and you have to work out your travel and work out which way you're going to go to get around the world and work out how you're going to spend your budget. Do you spend it on ships? Do you spend it on food? Do you spend it on getting a submersible? Like how do you get around there? And actually playing that with my boyfriend at the time was really fun because like couples fight over, I mean, they fight over unpacking, they fight over, I mean, Overcooked has destroyed how many marriages? So many.
Oh my god, that game.
And yeah, like 80 Days I'd actually really recommend, because it's beautifully written, the art style is spectacular, and it's actually really good, and you can go at your own speed, and you can do the voices and read stuff out loud, and I like doing voices, and have a good fight with whoever you're sat next to playing with you about how you're going to travel somewhere, which, you know, when it's not actually travelable and you're not stuck in an airport because someone's ticket didn't work, is actually can be fun. So yeah, I recommend 80 Days if you've got something else you want to play with your wife. It's really good.
Yeah, I would shout out nearly all of Justin Farris's game. Justin Farris? I forget his name now. But the dude that made A Way Out and It Takes Two and all that, and Brothers, A Tale of Two Sons. Like, A Way Out, going through that with a partner is really, really cool, especially with the story goes over time. Justin Farris.
It's also not very good doing that with a partner as well, as I seem to recall. Spoilers.
Yes, well, that's the thing. It depends how the story goes. But then there's loads of different ways that, like, the level designs play out where you're helping each other. And then as the story goes, different things might put you in adversarial positions. But still, I really like the way that kind of comes together. I did want to shout out, if you're talking about games that surprised you in terms of, like, visuals and presentation and stuff, 2016's The Witness. I really like Braid and I like Jonathan Blow. But The Witness was, like, phenomenal. And I feel like that game, it does get its due, because whenever it's brought up, every couple of years, it'll go viral again because people are discovering it again. But that game is such a phenomenal, unique puzzle game, and it's got such a great, like, underlying thematic about peacefulness and understanding the world, and there's a lot of, like, Buddhist teachings that are buried in there. But I just, overall, that game is phenomenal. And this year as well, I don't know if you've played Viewfinder, but, like, that blew me away mechanically. And my sister-in-law actually, like, worked on that game, so I remember when she showed me it months ago, and I was like, because if people don't know, that game's all about using a camera, it's like photos inside a 3D environment, and then you place the photo somewhere else, and the photo becomes 3D again. Once you move, you realize that it's actually filled everything out again, so you can move through worlds in a really, really unique way. And I've not seen anyone else do anything like that. Maybe there's more stuff like that on Steam or PC or whatever, but in the console space, just the way Viewfinder moves and the way it makes you think is phenomenal. It's quite short, and each, I think there's only 5 worlds, and each world has a different rule to it, but the level of charm and the level of ingenuity that's happening in that game is mind-blowing. If you want something this year to just sort of play and be like, I don't know how the hell they made this, that feeling is, at least to me, was like throughout Viewfinder. Final question from Tristan Vetter, who says, this year has been crazy with the amount of games that could be Game of the Year contenders, but which game do you think will lose out the most but could have won in any other year? I tell you what I think this is. I think Alan Wake is going to get pipped to the post by Baldur's. It depends what category we're talking.
And I'm the biggest, like, and you know, I'm the biggest Remedy fangirl that has ever been in this world. And I agree, it's too late in the year. There's not enough cosplay in it for the masses to adopt it. You know, we're living in a different time. Probably, yeah.
I just like the amount of game that's in Baldur's. I think it's a toss-up on the music side between, like, Baldur's and maybe Final Fantasy 16 in terms of, like, the big score of the year kind of thing. 16 might have taken it in another year as well. I know a lot of people don't like how action-focused that was, but personally speaking, that is my game of the year, at least for now. I've not finished Alan Wake 2 yet. But every beat of Alan Wake 2 is just so crystalline perfect. Like, it's incredible. But at the same time, I'll be amazed if it beats Baldur's, because Baldur's feels like a Red Dead Redemption 2. It just feels like it's way up there as this, like, monolithic release.
Yeah, I don't think things will come close. It would take either something absolutely huge or something that has the same power that Among Us or Fall Guys had when they came out, where it was just right time, right place. Everybody needed something to play like this that could just blow it out of the water. And I don't think we've had that this year, where, you know, there's been a phenomenon for the younger generation. We think about us a lot and what we like to play, but we don't think about, when it comes to when it comes to the main sort of award sweeps, a lot of children's games are in those categories and actually do tend to clean up too. And yeah, like, there hasn't been something this year that has captured the tweens at all. I think Baldur's Gate is quite mature. I think we should celebrate if that's what's actually getting everybody playing, and what's getting younger influencers playing, what's getting, you know, teens playing. I'd love it to be Baldur's if it was. That would be cool. I think that points to good things for games and the future of gaming.
Yeah, we'll see how things shake out. Like I said, Golden Joysticks are next week. The Game Awards are in December. I actually can't believe this year is coming to a close. I can't believe we're a month and a half, or 2 months, I guess, from the end of the year itself. It just feels like 2023 barely, like it's just been a blur of stuff, like the amount of different releases. It feels like Dead Space and Resident Evil 4 and Hi-Fi Rush were just a couple of months ago, and that was at the start of the year. For now, though, this has been the Untitled Banter Podcast, the UBP, the UBP, the U-Stevie. I've been Scott Tilford. That's been Stevie Ward.
Goodbye.
Thank you all very, very much for listening, and we'll catch you very soon. Goodbye.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.